I found truly that it's not autistic kids. They wake up and they automatically know how to use computers. Some of them are drawn to pattern recognition or problem solving, but they still using technology. And this is something that educators and researchers of young people in media talk about all the time. Just because you know how to do something materially or technologically doesn't mean you understand the social implications or can use it for sort of social skill or building a network. They're not the same thing. Adults are still needed. Mentorship is still needed.
I'm Erin Walsh. This is Connected and Courageous, the art and science of showing up for kids in the digital age, a podcast from Spark and Stitch Institute. There are a lot of stories flying around right now about teens and screens. The headlines are coming at us fast and furious, and sometimes these headlines are so helpful, they cue us into issues that deserve our attention. But generally speaking, young people and their experiences online are more complicated than any single story can capture. Today, we are talking to someone who has spent her entire career exploring the experiences of young people whose stories are often ignored or flattened by the media. As you will hear in this episode, Dr. Meryl Alper imagines a future that centers the worldviews, needs, and desires of neurodivergent and disabled youth. In this episode, you will be invited to consider questions like, what are some of the benefits unique to technology that tech offers autistic youth? Why should we be aware of the harmful tropes related to youth, autism, and media? How are young people making sense of their identities and diagnoses or lack of diagnoses on spaces like TikTok? And what are specific considerations for parents and educators to keep in mind related to online safety and thriving for neurodivergent kids? Dr. Meryl Alper had an early internship at Sesame Street's Education and Research Department. She'll talk about that a little bit today. So from the very beginning, she has been thinking about questions like, how do we make sure that media is informed by children's developmental needs? And how do we make sure that media experiences and research actually include everyone? She has committed her career to those questions. She is an associate professor in the Department of Communication Studies, an affiliate associate professor in the Department of Communication Sciences and Disorders at Northeastern University. She researches the social, cultural, and health implication of communication technologies with a focus on disability, digital media, and children and families' tech use. Dr. Alper is the author of Digital Youth with Disabilities and the award-winning Giving Voice, Mobile Communication, Disability, and Inequality. Her latest book, Kids Across the Spectrums, Growing Up Autistic in the Digital Age, explores the often misunderstood technology practices of young people on the autism spectrum, as well as what it means to be social in a hyper-mediated society. In her research and teaching, Dr. Alper also draws on 20 years of professional experience in the children's media industry. And she is here with us today. I would love to start with your story, how you, I mean, we don't have to start at birth, but I would love to know a little bit about how you got interested in the particular questions that you're investigating now.
Wonderful. Yes. No, thank you for that generous question. So my background, I've always been interested in kids and learning. And maybe as a kid who consumed a lot of media as a kid, gravitated towards that as an area of interest in study. But really, I think my story as a researcher starts during my undergraduate years when I was very lucky to start off at a work study job in a developmental psychology lab. But was really interested, I think, in life beyond the lab. How is any of this applied? And I had a mentor who had suggested that there was a new National Science Foundation lab that was starting up. I was at Northwestern, and the lab was going to be studying digital media and kids. It was one of kind of the first labs of its kind as part of a consortium. And I said, ooh, yes, that's something that is very interesting to me. And I guess the marrying of the research with it being applied beyond just, you know, everyday lived experience, I got to translate that right off the bat. I mean, I'm 19 years old, and I have an internship at Sesame Street. in the education and research department, working with the best possible people who absolutely are doing the research, reading the research. How do we make media that is informed by children's developmental needs? Thinking about, yes, those needs that are, you know, biological, that are not changing anytime soon, and yet responsive to trends and social mm-hmm. issues that absolutely affect children's environment. So I think that imprinting of me early on was so important. And I had other, you know, jobs in the field of children's media. I worked for Disney, I worked for Nickelodeon, you know, at Nickelodeon doing research, also developing children's TV. And those shows, and even with Sesame Street too, all of those shows had a fairly explicit inclusion mandate, thinking about who do we see on screen, who is our audience, and embracing that increasing, you know, diversity of young viewers. Mm-hmm. And so I started my PhD in 2010. And 2010 is also when the iPad came out. So I got interested in watching a bunch of YouTube videos that first, when the iPad came out, that parents posted of their young child playing with the iPad, you know, either saying, wow, look at how incredible my child is, or look at really a lot of it was how incredible this technology is. Wow, it's, you know, so easy, even a baby could use it. Or mm-hmm. even more, I think derisively, there was stuff, it's like, it's a computer so easy, like your grandma could use it. It was very gendered, very ageist.
Okay.
Yeah. It's like that discourse at that time. Anyway, so there was a whole subset, though, of videos that I didn't really know how to code, how to kind of assess in my study. And that was all these videos of parents of kids with disabilities mm-hmm. saying not, oh, look how incredible my child is, or look how incredible this technology is. But I didn't know that my child knew this. But now when I see them interacting with this technology, showing me what they know in terms of letters or language or just skills, that there's something that was brought out in them or just, you know, made evident through the technology. Hmm. And I came to realize that, well, what does the research say on this? And looking around in like my field of, you know, child development, media, technology, really young people with disabilities seem to be quite absent. Hmm. And any of the literature that existed was in maybe sort of more clinical research, so seeing kids as patients, or in the education field, so just as students, but none of this other sort of everyday life research. And so for me, I think what then drove me, what has been driving me, is this sense of, you know, walking the walk, talking the talk mm-hmm. around, you know, really trying to increase, you know, opportunity, access, inclusion, equity for young people in making the, you know, getting the most out of technology and also preventing mm-hmm. harms that we know can be particularly, you know, deleterious in terms of, you know, what that level of impact can be, particularly mm-hmm. for marginalized youth. But that inclusion of disability as part of the conversation, just trying to make that ever present for me as part of my commitment to social justice in that respect.
Yeah.
Could media and technology be helping for some, hurting others? Yeah. Which specific media and technology under what conditions? So
those
are two questions that are driving my research at the moment.
Yeah, I love that. And I want to actually, given our focus on sort of tech and teens, of course, everyone right now is like mental health for good reason, right? I mean, there's a lot of concern and there's a lot of suffering. And to help get into some of that complexity, let's come back to that in a moment. But there was so much that you just said that is so rich. And one of the things that jumps out to me is this beautiful story of the parents realizing that they're learning about their child through their digital experiences. I think as I work with caregivers and educators across the country, one of these dominant stories that tends to be top of mind, especially when we think about youth with autism, is more of this sort of, we need to protect youth from screen media, which will be an inherently negative force, especially for autistic youth. There's this idea that it sort of is inherently bad. And what I hear from you and what I know from your research is that it's a much more, of course, which Spark and Stitch listeners will not be surprised, it's a much more complicated story. So can you talk a little bit about why that mindset for an educator or a parent of assuming that tech is bad, especially when it comes to neurodivergent young people, is kind of flattening some of their experiences and what the costs of that might be and what you've heard from families or young people yourself?
Yeah. So I conveniently have a recent op-ed that I wrote that's in Newsweek exactly in response to some of this. So, you know, I want to say, you know, don't get me wrong, there are absolutely terrible uses of social media and yes. gaming platforms and possibilities for extremely bad actors to take advantage of children in ways that the platform policies and laws have not been able to keep up with. Yeah. And losing sight of the good, I argue in that piece, like, can also have its own harms associated with it. That there are some benefits that tech, uniquely technology, offers autistic youth that you can't get from just, you know, I think, what did I read the other day? Like, what, you know, kids should just play outside. And it's like, okay, like, is that neighborhood safe for an autistic child to do? Like, in what ways might that safety be very compromised if, you know, that child is a Black autistic child for whom, like, the police upon those encounters do not assume to be a child at all, and make the worst assumptions. So just the way in which those arguments are so, I think, from a particular perspective that that aren't really thinking about the technology enters into some kind of social setting, social context, lived experiences, environment, space. Yeah. So I think the tech is bad, you know, that drive. One thing about it is that it's, you know, academics will, a lot of times, will, or at least theorists will use this phrase that things are technologically determinist. Like, it's the technology, I talk about this with my students a lot, is this driving force. It makes us do things. It enchants us.
It's in charge.
It's in charge, right. And at the same time, though, so the flip side of that is social determinism, like people have the power, or people are inherently one way or the other. And that can come out in the idea, like, all autistic youth are inherently vulnerable. And so I wanted to avoid that, too, because basically tech is used by people and created by people. And so the people part, I think, is really important. So we can talk about the technology, but then sometimes we then lose the sight of peers. So, like, you know, whether those peers are autistic or non-autistic in these online and also offline spaces. So media can, for example, in unique ways that cannot be necessarily replicated without media, but can bring autistic children together with friends in ways that might be very challenging on the playground. You know, one important area I look at in my book is emotions and emotional development. So how are, you know, what I found is autistic kids are absolutely actively using media and technology to understand emotions, experience emotions, express, manage their emotions. Again, not always necessarily in ways that are helpful ultimately, but they are still making active choices, not just the tech doing to them.
Is there a story that comes to mind or a specific example where you had one of these moments of like, oh, something really important is happening here that's beneficial, that is unique to technology? Can you think of something that comes to mind, a story or an example?
Yeah, a couple different ones. So I'm thinking of, you know, often the discussions around autistic, you know, children and friendships and like social missed social opportunities or a lack of social skills assumes that the player social partner is neurotypical. And so thinking about, you know, neurodivergent kids enjoying the company of other neurodivergent kids and the ways that their play might not look like the kind of play that neurodivergent kids are engaging in or what social play looks like. So I'm thinking of, you know, one child, one mom who was talking about how her child, you know, her child love when they have a play date with another boy, another autistic boy in their class, they will watch videos of, you know, of gamers playing with one another. And so they are not themselves playing the game together or necessarily so much interacting. They are observing social interaction and learning from that. I mean, they're also learning like tips on how to play the games and all that other sort of stuff. But there is something social from a particular. And not to say the gamers are like necessarily always the best people to be learning any of these social interactions from, but sometimes, yes, rapport, humor, you know, responding to when somebody does something to you that you don't like, they are in some ways like self-selected and interest-driven teaching tools in that kind of way that can be hard to just in an offline, I guess, like social skills class be replicating.
Yeah. Do you have tips for, you know, I'm picturing some of the parents that I've worked with or have asked us questions where because there is this fear about specifically things like gaming, and you read like, oh, there's associations between, you know, youth with autism, maybe have there's a stronger association with overuse or problematic use. And so do you have tips for or strategies for ways to kind of hold those strengths and that concern at the same time? Because I can imagine, you know, a parent is watching their autistic child playing or watching gamers, but instead of seeing that as a shared media experience, a shared social experience, they're like, uh-oh, gaming. Mm-hmm. This must be inherently bad. So how do we sort of help hold that concern while also being open to what an incredible social experience to be able to share with each other?
Yeah, I'm thinking of research on autistic adults and their experiences where they run into challenges with gaming platforms, with social media. And some of that has to do with the sensory experience. And so I think that in some respects, or finding it very difficult to stop using, because the way these technologies are designed, they are meant to keep you there and to lose track of time and to be fully immersed in the experience. And so I think that there is a place for conversations with autistic children about the mindfulness with which they are present in their play, or kind of tapping into their sense of interoception, you know, when you feel discomfort, when you are hungry, you know, there's certainly this, or executive functioning issues of, you know, maybe you should, you know, maybe you need a timer to remember, like to check in with yourself, like, am I hungry? Do I feel like I could use a drink, that I should stand up? You know, that you might need that kind of scaffolding to take breaks or to help transition from an activity to the other. But I think just placing it on a child and not having a child be part of the active construction of these tools, I think for one thing, it doesn't set kids up well for potentially like additional independent use as an adult. And at the same time, I don't want to let these platforms off the hook either, because you know, it's not all on parents or on autistic people. You know, there's not a lot of transparency or the ability to make or modify these things or these platforms as well.
Some of these strategies are so helpful for all of us. And I hear that in your book, right? We assume that it's like neurotypical young people must need this and neurodivergent youth must need this. And of course, there's unique needs, unique strengths, unique vulnerabilities. And there's these sort of like beautiful protective factors for all of us, that pausing to pay attention to our bodies, pausing to think, is this a place I want to be or not want to be, feels like really helpful scaffolding for all of us. And it sounds like you're inviting us to maybe observe our young people or be in conversation with them, right? Is there a specific platform that is especially activating, or a show that causes a ton of dysregulation? And there's another show that, or another form of game that is maybe a little bit less, or maybe they have the skills to be able to manage some of that a little better. And I really appreciated the stories that you shared about sort of young people finding each other in these servers and sort of not just playing Minecraft together, but also doing some identity work, doing some friendship work. And is that something that you saw? Like, Minecraft is obviously an example that I think many of us are pleased to see, like, okay, good things can happen.
And so a bunch of that work I'd point to a friend of mine, Catherine Ringland, who's a professor right now at UC Santa Cruz in their computational media department, who did a bunch of digital ethnography among kind of embedded herself in kind of autism focused Minecraft servers. So the kids that I was spending time with, they were maybe not, I mean, there's like a highly specialized kind of server. But for some of these kids, it was, you know, family gaming as an inroads to that. But again, even then, I might talk about this in the emotional development chapter, like still moments of meltdowns and having to talk about, you know, like a mine cart, like, you know, that you run into something where it's, this moment is pressurized, this moment is not fun anymore. Yeah. And how do you want to have family time and at the same time balance the fact that there are individual needs that if you don't address them at the moment, then there is no more family time. Yeah. You know, this moment is no longer.
And I think in some ways we've been talking about gaming a little bit, but I know that a lot of educators and caregivers are really curious about, concerned about, overwhelmed about the headlines related to sort of adolescent mental health. And certainly parents of neurodivergent youth, parents of youth with autism, I think have specific questions. And I wonder if you can talk a little bit about that same complexity when it comes to things like mental health TikTok, things like social media.
Yeah. So I feel like I would never tell somebody, get your child on TikTok.
Yeah. We don't have a lot of good evidence.
Right. Yeah. Like it's filled with hate speech. It's a trash fire. It's all of those things.
Algorithmically bonkers. Yeah.
Right. Right. So, it's the kind of thing where I think about, this is maybe a sentiment aside, but I think this maybe like 10 years ago, there are professors who would, for a class project, have their students create a Twitter account.
Right.
And now I think of that as just like negligence. Like never forcefully like make somebody enter that toxic space. Yeah. So I always hesitate to say like it's garbage on many levels for many things. And it's also at the same time evidence that we have of when it comes to mental health, when it comes to talking about this paper that I published with a group of collaborators that is about diagnosis. So this is certainly this is for some of the sort of teens and young adult space of young people, particularly those who if they were receiving a diagnosis, did not get one as a child, or even if they did, are making sense of that as part of their adolescent identity development. And so the ways in which this is absolutely a space for them to work through what diagnosis means, if they don't have one, to find support for being this sort of liminal, not quite in it, not quite out of it. And at the same time, the platform is, and this is what we find, and this is from looking at, 600 something videos, like 20,000 comments. This is also a space where people are saying, hey, like, I do feel like the algorithm brought me here. And that makes me feel kind of weird. And I feel like I'm being surveilled in a kind of way. And that doesn't make me comfortable either. So whether, again, this is hard to say, we aren't able, because we don't have access to the actual algorithm, to say what the algorithm is itself actually doing. But it is perceived in this way to be kind of intrusive, to be nudging, to direct people in a way that for some people it is helpful. For some people it does then lead them to resources. It leads them to connections. But that is not necessarily, that is not necessarily the case for other people. So there's an ethical responsibility that comes with that, which I don't think platforms at all are capable of addressing.
Right.
So
you might have a particular vulnerability. They're not thinking, how do we design for the healthy development of autistic youth? Right?
Not
at all. Yeah. Yeah. But it sounds like one of the things that you're inviting us to do is to, this is not a case for mental health advocacy. Ideal format is TikTok or Instagram. And we know that young people are actively in these spaces, trying to make sense of their identities, trying to make sense of their friendships. What are the role of parents, educators in sort of helping them in that sense making, helping them kind of do some discernment, and also making sure that if there is offline supports that they need, right? So is it about asking questions? What kind of practical guidance do you think is most helpful as we think about adolescents in particular? I mean,
right. Yeah. I know this is like weird for me to do as like a pitch, to be like, if there's any funders out there that want to fund this research, but there is actually like truly a real gap or lack in there's all this media literacy education that is out there that, Common Sense Media has so many fantastic resources. Yeah. And some of those might be very relevant and might be, really just concrete and accessible and useful for, I should say, neurodivergent kids, but also very often, because there's a hereditary component to it. Yeah. Neurodivergent kids might have neurodivergent parents. Yeah. And so really thinking about holistically, how might these materials be accessible? We do have some research on what autistic, adolescent and sort of young adult and adult social media users say, here's the challenges that we come up against, is walking through the settings, basically, like walking through, here are the options. Because often parents, they don't know that much about, the settings. And it's an opportunity for, hey, let's find out more about that. What does that mean if that's turned on or off? What does that do? So this, the collective exploration where parents get to sort of put kids in the position of being experts, but at the same time, parents not saying, I'm a Luddite, or I don't know anything, because parents, you know, they bring a wealth of experience to being, you know, not just being on social media, but being a social actor right. in the world. But I think that that's incredibly useful, or it's really a necessity when we think about all of the ways now that it isn't just about the content that you might create, but considering all of the challenges of things like generative AI, the kinds of content that might be created that is inherently meant to deceive, that is, yeah. or is a fakery that is meant to harm and meant to hurt. Yeah. And at the same time, I think that autistic, you know, this is where it's not always about vulnerability. I think that in some ways, some autistic kids might be particularly well-skilled at figuring mm-hmm. out like what those fakeries are. Like if you're really good at pattern recognition and detail, yeah. like you might be the first person to notice that like, wow, that hand isn't where a hand should be.
Right, right.
You know, so again, I want to think about, you know, where might there be like a strength? Where might that be an asset? Where could this yeah. kid be really good at figuring that part out?
Yeah.
But the social kind of ethics of what do you do when you see a picture that's been doctored or somebody you know, and how do you go through with that? That could be extremely stressful for yeah. an autistic
yeah.
child. So
yeah.
That's why I think my personal thought is that whatever media literacy education like should or does exist, or even when parents are doing, you know, sitting down or educators,
yeah.
is to be as concrete as possible with specific examples and specific steps. And certainly talking about generalizability, it's not always going to look like this, the challenge that you encounter or the experience, but having something to work with in that respect can be very helpful.
I really appreciate that. I think that's probably something that we could all use. We often say things like, be kind online. And it's like, well, what does that actually look like? This is a stressful situation. I don't know what kindness looks like in this situation. And I know that walking through some of that can be really, really helpful. I think that there are these really strong media representations of youth with autism that are very stereotyped and can be very flattening. And one of the things that I learned from your book was that, you know, the internet is a place where autistic youth can find a more complex representation of their identities. In some ways, we have this incredible moment of possibility for our kids to find mirrors and windows into their identities in ways that's really exciting. And in other ways, right, it's just an overwhelming online world where there's a lot of harmful things too. But can you talk a little bit about the importance of media representation and maybe ways that parents can respect the need for that or seeking out media that helps young people do that? And just talk a tiny bit about that.
Yeah. So one thing I found that I thought was an interesting kind of finding, and I dig into it in the chapter on identity, is that autistic kids absolutely, you know, are creating their own representations, whether that's through like so one kid, for example, was really into Scratch, which is like a user-generated mm-hmm. collaborative remix gaming and computer coding platform, and sort of creating characters that represented him or the kind of the multifacetedness of his creative, you know, expression or authorship, you know, on whether it is kind of old school blogs or like self-publishing books or making videos, and in some ways to counter the sort of complete lack of people that look or have similar skills or ability levels relative to them. But it's interesting too, because I found also that autistic kids, even without a character being autistic, disability, like positive mm-hmm. Or kind of stories that kids related to, they're related to disability, not just autism, mm-hmm. were still useful and kids identified as helpful. Like I have a whole section that's about the book and movie series of books of Wonder. That's not to say that we shouldn't have more autistic representation, but it's not as if disability representation in yeah. general wasn't also having some kind of positive effect on these yeah. kids. So yeah, but I think that the overall, yeah, the representations that, you know, kids and parents were talking about, you know, they're not all computer savvy tech geeks. This isn't, and not everybody is Sheldon from Big Bang right. Theory, who even actually, you know, isn't explicitly called autistic in the show. And because of that, it gets to not really be addressed. And, you know, and so what I think, for example, then gets missed is, you know, it's not autistic kids. They wake up and they automatically know how to use computers. Some okay. of them are drawn to pattern recognition or problem solving, but they still using technology. And this is something that educators and researchers of young people in media talk about all the time. Just because you know how to do something materially or technologically doesn't mean you understand the social implications or can mm-hmm. use it for sort of social skill or kind mm-hmm. of building a network. They're not the same thing. Adults are still needed. Mentorship is still needed. So I think that, yeah, just the assumption that they know how to do it really leaves them alone in ways that can then be really harmful. But yeah, they're not also kind of media myths that are around sort of video gaming and violence, that they're all sort of heavy internet users that are at risk for social isolation. Also harmful because autistic people are very often the victims themselves of aggression online and offline. And then lastly, I think that this is more speaking to some general kind of moral panics, but around just the idea that screens cause autism, that's something that I think is a particularly toxic framing. I mean, we know that it certainly, you know, autism is a developmental disability and babies aren't watching screens in utero. At the same time, of course, you know, screens could be interacting with features of autism at early ages, or with the pair, with the kind of social context of parents, that could be disrupting emotional, language, and behavioral development. But again, the sort of danger that it is causing is, I think, part of a broader, I think, parents of neurodivergent kids enter into an environment with a lot of pseudoscience and misinformation around science and medical advice. And I think that's one thread that comes through that is really not helpful as part of that larger backdrop.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And knowing, it feels like naming some of those tropes, some of those harmful stereotypes can be helpful to give them a little less power. And I'm wondering if you have any sort of final thoughts, or what we think of as like an invitation for an act of connection or courage, or, you know, it doesn't have to be this as your grand thesis, this will solve everything. But as you think about the work that you've done with families of adolescents with autism or autistic children, you know, what's like one warm invitation that you want to give parents or educators based on some of the insights you've gained? It's like, well, maybe tomorrow I invite you to try to do this. And it can be simple, but anything that you want to invite folks to do based on some of what the rich research that you've done.
Oh, wow. It's hard to do this one giant rich takeaway.
And it doesn't have to be big. Small is great. Small is sometimes very nice. Yeah. It doesn't have to solve everything.
Right. Because I do want to touch back on just one thing you had said about sleep. And that's one of those areas where autistic adults in particular say, like, this is where we need more research. This is where we need more support. And yet we also have all this research on young people in media and the ways that because autistic people very often have sleep that is highly dysregulated and not knowing why and how to fix that. And screens, of course, can enter into that and be extra disruptive for a child who might wake up, you know, at hours that are just really not conducive for then making it through the school day. So I'd say sleep is one of those areas where absolutely that needs to be protected. And that's where I would sort of say, like, that's where you do need some kind of really need help. Like you should intervene. Yeah. Because we know that sleep is thinking about how that relates to mental health. It is such a big piece of the pie, being able to have a good night's sleep. And already these kids, many of them are disadvantaged in that respect.
Yeah. I appreciate you bringing that up in some ways, because there is, I think for those of us who are trying to walk people towards the complexity of the research, there can be this feeling of like, well, do we know nothing? Like, is it all so complicated? There's no advice. And it's like, no, there really, we do have some sense of, and I think sleep is one of those places where it's not that like compelling to talk about as like a hot topic, because it's sort of boring in some ways and so essential. Just, we could not have more research on how important sleep is. So I appreciate you coming back. It's like, if the invitation is for us to, if there's a place to set a bold boundary and really work hard on setting up that important sort of guardrail for mental health and well-being, sleep. We can always go back to the research on sleep. Anyway, but you were going to say, you were.
Oh, no, I think that's actually even like a better takeaway. Like, that's, if you're going to hold the line on something, it should be that.
Yeah, I love that. Well, in many ways, I love this maybe as a place to wrap up. We will make sure to link to your book. We'll make sure to link to your resources. And I really appreciate the invitation for research and curiosity and questions around neurodivergent youth and their media experiences. So may you continue to get lots of funding.
Thank you. From your mouth to the NSF and the NIH's ears.
Yeah, exactly. There's a straight line. Spark and Stitch podcast is really... thank you so much. Thank you for being here. And thank you for your work and for your heart.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Connected and Courageous, the art and science of showing up for kids in the digital age, a podcast brought to you by the Spark and Stitch Institute. This podcast is hosted by me, Erin Walsh. Many thanks to our series producer, Beth Gibbs of Lyft Podcasting. Music is Still Going Instrumental by John Worthy Music. Warm reminder that the Connected and Courageous podcast does not constitute medical advice and is not a substitute for professional mental health advice, diagnosis, or treatment. If you have concerns about your child's well-being, consult a physician or mental health professional. For notes, resources, and ways to deepen your engagement with Spark and Stitch or today's guest, visit sparkandstitchinstitute.com. Be sure to subscribe in order to stay up to date with all of the latest offerings. Again, thank you so much for listening. Stay connected, stay courageous.